Young, it's here and now. In a moment, why are so many candidates talking about congressional committees this campaign season? But first, has the predicted Democratic wave ebbed? New York Senator Charles Schumer recently predicted Democrats would ride a huge tsunami of votes on Election Day. Political pundit Charlie Cook called it a Category 5 hurricane. Well, now there are hints that forecast may fall short. For instance, embattled Republican Tom Reynolds plunged in the polls after he was caught up in the Mark Foley email scandal. But then Reynolds crawled his way back after a visit from White House political guru Karl Rove. Rove insists the midterm elections next week will go well for the GOP, leading everyone to ask, what does Rove know, and could he be right? Joining us from Washington, Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Peter, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
And we're in the last few days before the election. You write that means that the Republican machine led by Karl Rove has moved into endgame?
Yes, they have. They're moving now into what they call the 72-hour program, which is a very sophisticated, finely tuned program that Karl Rove and Ken Mellman, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, and other Republican thinkers have come up with. Really, since 2000, when they came up shorter than they had hoped,
and studied the Democrats to see how they did it, and that's when Karl Rove reportedly came up with this idea of more face-to-face contact.
That's right. It's a program. They use a database, a massive voter database called Voter Vault, which is a nationwide database. But it can be really it's something that campaign managers and competitive House districts, even state legislative districts, can use to find the universe of voters that they need to turn out. And they build this database using all sorts of consumer data. But where it comes into play now is that suddenly campaign operatives, campaign staffers, can print out names, addresses, phone numbers. They can figure out, they know, based on data research, exactly who they need to reach. And then they can send out volunteers, neighbors, people, fellow church members, people who can actually have person-to-person contact, as you said, with these voters. And Republicans have found that this is a lot more effective than what Democrats have relied on the last few cycles, which is paid staffers.
And Republicans are saying that in a race that's close, this is where, you know, they can make the difference. Where are some of these, races that they're targeting? I'm thinking Missouri and Tennessee.
Yes, exactly. Those are two good examples. Missouri and Tennessee, the Republican or Senate races that are neck and neck right now. And the Republicans do have heavy staffing there, a huge volunteer list, and the micro-targeting, as it's called, is in full effect. And those are two races that, if the polls show the Republican tied with the Democrat or even a little bit behind, Republicans feel that they can eke out a few extra percentage points through the micro-targeting. There's also some House races around the country. In Minnesota, the Republicans have sophisticated micro-targeting. There's a competitive race in South Florida. Clay Shaw, the congressman there, trying to hold on to a seat against a pretty stiff challenge from a Democratic state senator. That Republicans feel that they have an advantage because of micro-targeting. There's examples like that across these two or three dozen House seats that are extremely close. And when Karl Rove looks at internal polls and looks at polling for all of these competitive races, he thinks that that Republicans could actually minimize their losses to the point where they would only lose 12 seats. So
and the Democrats would need 15 to win the majority.
15 to win the majority, that's exactly right. So they do see a path to victory here, and they think that in order, they would have to win almost every close race in order to keep the majority.
Well, and we've seen an example of how they've already had an impact. You write about Karl Rove's influence in the Tom Reynolds race in upstate New York. Reynolds, of course, as we mentioned, the Republican campaign leader in the House who slipped in the polls because of his involvement in the Mark Foley scandal. It was said he knew about emails early on. And Karl Rove paid a visit, the White House says, coincidentally, right when there was a huge snowstorm in the Buffalo, New York area. And shortly after, Tom Reynolds could announce federal funds coming that district's way.
That's true. That actually, my co-author on the story, Tom Hamburger, figured that out. What really didn't get as much attention during that visit was when Karl had a private briefing with a local FEMA official, and then 4 days later, Tom Reynolds was able to stand up at a press conference and announce the disaster declaration after this freak snowstorm and kind of triggering millions of dollars in federal aid. And no one's questioning the legitimacy of the disaster declaration or the merit of it either. But this is an example where the White House just takes advantage of these situations very well. And it's what we argue in a book that actually Tom Hamburger and I co-authored, One Party Country, that is a politicization of policy under this administration that has been used very effectively to win elections at the local level.
Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, also co-author of One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Well, why is control of Congress so important to both parties? It would seem obvious, but today we want to dig a little deeper into what's become a controversial campaign issue, congressional committee leadership. The party in power holds the keys to what happens on Capitol Hill because their members chair the committees where the real work gets done. And Vice President Cheney, for one, has been pounding away at the notion that if Republicans lose control of Congress, Democrats such as Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank will become powerful committee chairs. And as Cheney says, I don't need to tell you what kind of legislation would come from that. Indiana Republican Congressman John Hostetler, facing a tough re-election battle against Democrat Brad Ellsberg, takes that rallying cry a little further. Let's listen to one of his ads.
Why are liberals smearing Congressman Hostetler? Because they want you to vote for Brad Ellsworth so he can cast his first vote for Speaker of the House for San Francisco liberal Nancy Pelosi. Speaker Pelosi will then put in motion her radical plan to advance the homosexual agenda led by Barney Frank, reprimanded by the House after paying for sex with a man who ran a gay brothel out of Congressman Frank's home. Speaker Pelosi will reauthorize the Clinton gun ban, give amnesty to millions of illegal aliens with Detroit liberal John Conyers, and raise taxes with New York liberal Charlie Rangel. I know what you're thinking. Is this true? Well, do you feel lucky? Go ahead. Vote for Brad Ellsworth. Make Nancy Pelosi's day.
We turn now to David Hawkins, managing editor of CQ Weekly, Congressional Quarterly Weekly. David, have you ever seen campaign committee chairs and potential speakers spoken about on the campaign trail?
Not as prominently as this time. This is sort of an occasional theme of the Republicans, but I think you're absolutely right. This is more of a theme than ever before. And there is some truth to that ad.
Such as?
Those people would be the, would get the jobs that Mr. Hostetler says they would get. The question, and I think it's a very much an open question, is just how liberal an agenda would the Democrats push?
And how much of a radical homosexual agenda, of course, referring to Congressman Barney Frank, openly gay, was reprimanded by the House Ethics Committee?
He was, and he did. That part of the ad is more or less true, that he did end up having a boyfriend who was running a prostitution ring out of the congressman's basement. Now, this, I believe, was about 15 years ago, but it has very little to do with what Barney Frank would do as the chairman of the banking committee.
Well, I was going to ask, Barney Frank in line for the finance committee, has anyone said how a radical homosexual agenda might be implemented through a finance committee?
That's a great question, because no, I don't think there's anything, there's really nothing that I can think of that the Financial Services Committee has jurisdiction of that would allow the promotion of the so-called radical homosexual agenda. Mr. Frank is clearly somebody who's supportive of civil liberties, and perhaps radical homosexual agenda is a code word for that. And Mr. Frank is also a senior member of the Judiciary Committee, and if the Democrats hold the House long enough, if they win on November 7th and hold it for probably more than one or two terms, Mr. Frank would be in line to move from financial services to judiciary and would presumably bring a sort of more of an attention to civil liberties.
Barney Frank has also been in a very public spat with Republicans following the Mark Foley scandal, saying that Republicans criticized gay behavior and then closed the door and did it themselves, calling them hypocrites. So this is, you know, there's much of an undercurrent here. Who would he replace should the Democrats win on Tuesday? Who would he replace on the House Committee on Financial Services?
Well, actually, the current chairman is retiring, a guy named Mike Oxley from Ohio, very much of a friend of the financial services industry. But to be sure, Mr. Frank, as the top Democrat, now he's what we call the ranking minority party member. He's the top Democrat on the committee. And Barney Frank's behavior on that committee has been, I would say, in the mainstream. Barney Frank knows financial services issues. He knows banking. He's a friend of bankers up to a point. He would like more attention paid in federal policy to affordable housing, to allowing poor people to get mortgages. But he doesn't, in my in my observation, doesn't bring any sort of radical agenda to banking and financial services. I mean, he's not trying to sort of get rid of the gold standard or anything.
Michael Cranish, writing in the Boston Globe, quotes a lot of banking leaders as saying the same thing. And he also mentions that there have been other attacks. House Majority Whip Roy Blunt issued a press release saying that Frank supports very scary legislation such as Medicare coverage of adult diapers.
It is very easy to suspect that what is going on here with that ad is the Republican candidate is trying to appeal to his conservative base of support. If they know anything about Barney Frank, it's that he's gay, so they're afraid that a gay person will chair a committee. And if they know anything about John Conyers and Charlie Rangel, it's that they're African American. And it is pretty easy to suspect that what's going on here is an appeal to prejudice against blacks and gay people.
And Charlie Rangel of New York in line to take over House Ways and Means. What is the Republican criticism of them been?
Well, Mr. Conyers is clearly a liberal. He is somebody who has made more noise than most Democrats about an interest in maybe impeaching President Bush. So that gives the Republicans some ammunition to say if John Conyers becomes the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, we're going to start impeachment proceedings against President Bush. John Conyers' past interest in impeaching President Bush is true. Now, what that part of the story leaves out is that Nancy Pelosi, the would-be speaker, has already made clear to John Conyers, if we take the majority, we don't want any talk of impeachment. Mm. Leads me to what I think is an important point, which is that if the Democrats win control of the House, Nancy Pelosi is a pragmatist and somebody who will love being speaker and will want to be speaker for more than 2 years. And she will not, in my prediction, she will not push a so-called radical liberal agenda because her main interest is in holding on to a Democratic majority for more than 2 years. And she's fully aware politically that if she pushes things too far to the left, she'll splinter her own Democratic caucus, which is not liberals, moderates, and conservatives, and she'll alienate the voters. So she's already told John Conyers, no more talk of impeachment.
Okay, maybe no more talk of impeachment. What about investigations into the use of intelligence in the run-up to the war in Iraq? We want to ask David Hawkins about that. He's managing editor of CQ Weekly, Congressional Quarterly Weekly. Also want to ask about committee leadership in Congress, how it would change if Republicans lose control of either the House or the Senate. We're going to take a quick break, come back with David Hawkins. But first, let's remind ourselves what some more of these committees are. The Senate Judiciary, Arlen Specter, the Republican from Pennsylvania, waiting in the wings, Patrick Leahy, he's the ranking Democrat from Vermont. Senate Appropriations, Thad Cochran from Mississippi, Robert Byrd, the Democrat from West Virginia, said to be ready to assume that seat should the Democrats win big on Tuesday. House Appropriations, Jerry Lewis, no relation, in California. David Obey is the Democrat from Wisconsin, hoping to take over that chair. The Senate Armed Services Committee, John Warner, the Republican of Virginia, his term limit is up. Carl Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, is hoping to take that leadership. The House Armed Services Committee is headed by Duncan Hunter from California. Ike Skelton from Missouri, the Democrat, is hoping to move in. And as we said, the House Committee on Financial Services, it's currently chaired by Michael Oxley of Ohio, the Republican. Barney Frank, the Democrat of Massachusetts, has been eyeing that piece of furniture as well. Stay with us. Much more coming up about what these committee chairs mean and how they could change. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. We're back with more of our look at what's at stake for both political parties in next Tuesday's election. We're talking specifically about committee chairs and control of the legislative agenda with David Hawkins. He's managing editor of CQ Weekly, Congressional Quarterly Weekly. David, before the break, you said there might not be impeachment hearings if the Democrats do take control because of Nancy Pelosi's edict. But would there be investigations of the Bush administration if the Democrats win?
Yes, I would say that it is absolutely true that the Democrats' principal power for the next 2 years will be in oversight and investigations of the administration. If what we think is going to happen happens 1 week before the election, we think that it's likely that the Democrats will take control of the House, and it's less likely but still possible that they could take over the Senate. But I would say if we had to bet today, narrowly Republican Senate, narrowly Democratic House. So that means we'll have split government. So the ability of the House Democratic majority to legislate, to do much effective legislating, is pretty limited. But what they can do is investigate, there's a long and proud tradition in this country of the part. party out of power, or the party that runs Congress, investigating and overseeing and holding accountable a president of the other party. It's what happened in the mid-90s when the Republicans first took over Congress. It's what they did to President Clinton on Whitewater, on Travelgate, on several other things.
Well, and there's an exception, if you will, currently, and that is Arlen Specter. Arlen Specter chairing the Senate Judiciary Committee, a Republican, and some say the only committee that's been dealing with some of these controversial issues. If the Democrats' wave continues to the Senate, would be knocked out by Patrick Leahy. But it sounds as if you and others are saying that Arlen Specter might hold that seat, which, again, ironically, he might be one of the voices questioning the administration along with the new Democratic chairs.
That's true. I mean, let's remember that the president is heading into his final 2 years in office. He will be a lame duck. He has not anointed a successor. This is the first time in half a century where no sitting president or sitting vice president is going to be running for president. So the president's legislative agenda, I think it's safe to say, will be pretty marginalized pretty quickly.
Well, just taking a look at some of the other committees, and by the way, one other falls into that same category. John Warner, a Republican of Virginia, currently heads the Senate Armed Services Committee. He's called for investigations into several aspects of the war in Iraq.
He's also out as Armed Services Committee chairman no matter what, just because of the way the Republicans have term limits for their own chairman. And Senator Warner has completed his time-limited time as chairman of the Armed Services Committee, so he will be moving on and will be replaced by presidential want-to-be John McCain.
Or if the Democrats sweep through the Senate, Carl Levin of Michigan.
Correct. Right. Carl Levin of Michigan, who will be somewhat different, although, again, I would say that, as we discussed a few minutes ago with Barney Frank and the Banking Committee, Carl Levin does not have a radically different approach to the defense of the country. He and Warner disagree in important areas about defense priorities and certainly about the war. But Carl Levin is not some sort of radical disarmer. Mm-hmm. And the two of them have worked well very collegially. It's a very bipartisan committee, so I would expect a difference in tone, some differences that defense experts will notice, but not some radical change.
And the House Armed Services Committee, currently head by Duncan Hunter, a Republican of California,
right,
with Ike Skelton, a Democrat from Missouri.
That's the least change of all. Even Dick Cheney would agree that Ike Skelton's about the best friend that the president has in the Democratic side on defense matters.
Yeah.
I think that's one that they're not talking about. I think they're talking a lot about Rangel. If we could go back to Rangel for a minute, mm-hmm. They fear that Rangel would do away with all the Bush tax cuts.
That's Charlie Rangel, the Democrat from New York, waiting in the wings, hoping that he will get a shot at the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, that chairmanship currently held by Bill Thomas, a Republican from California.
Correct.
David Hawkins, Managing Editor of CQ Weekly, Congressional Quarterly Weekly. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, today is Halloween, and for some, there's nothing scarier than the thought of opening the door to see yet the face of another politician making a pitch for your vote. Trick-or-treaters know they can strike fear, loathing, and laughter by wearing a political mask, and they're flocking to costume stores who are doing a brisk business. One for the last time. Here and Now producer Kevin Sullivan went to Boston Costume to check out this year's most popular political masks.
David Bertolino from Boston Costume here on Neyland Street in Chinatown. I've seen a lot of political masks selling this year, but as they do every year. But surprisingly, one of the strongest political masks is the Richard Nixon.
Well, I'm not a crook.
And, the Nixon mask still sells as strong even during when he was in office as it does now.
Well, I'm not a crook.
And as always, the current seated president is a top seller. Both people who love him and hate him purchased the Bush mask for Halloween. But surprisingly, this year, the vice president mask sold almost as well, especially with the optional plastic shotgun.
I'm the guy who pulled the trigger and shot my friend.
Cheney, with the incident of shooting his attorney in the face, made that a much-in-demand costume this year.
My name's Scott Farrell Forstein. We've had people come in with for JFK. We've had people come in and get the Bill Clinton mask, and then they thought about getting the Hillary, but then they were like, no, we'll just get the Bill Clinton. We've had people go for John Kerry, and actually one person's whole idea was to get this big red circle. The whole face just looks like it's sagging down, just like droopy and sad. The Hillary mask has this smile to it. Its nose, Hillary doesn't have a big nose like that, and they've like enlarged her forehead and given her like these sets of earrings. I guess that's to get it across that it's a female mask. They kind of gave it more of a manly face.
The great story here is this vast right-wing conspiracy.
It's always fun and exciting to host these people, and it's made it interesting over the years.
Well, as we said, this is the last Halloween for Boston Costume. The store is going out of business after 38 years because of rising rents. So starting tomorrow, Clinton, Nixon, Kerry, Cheney, and Pirates of the Caribbean, apparently the hottest costume, all half price. More ahead, here and now. Funding here and now. The Episcopal Church of America will consecrate Bishop Katharine Jeffords Shorey this week as primate or leader. She'll be the first woman to lead a national Episcopal church anywhere in the world, and she's facing a possible schism. In 2003, the elevation of an openly gay Episcopal priest, Gene Robinson, to the bishophood created deep divisions within the church. The Archbishop of Canterbury tried to heal those divisions with the Windsor Report, which asked the American church to apologize and declare a moratorium on the elevation of gay priests and the blessing of same-sex marriages. Well, the American church politely declined at their general convention. Now, the election of Bishop Katharine, who supports both gay priests and same-sex marriages, has some U.S. Episcopal diocese trying to split from the American church. We spoke recently with Bishop Katharine, as she asked us to call her. Today we turn to one of her critics, the Right Reverend Jack Leo Eicher, Bishop of Fort Worth, Texas. And Bishop Eicher, welcome.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Well, immediately after Bishop Katharine was elected, you asked the Archbishop of Canterbury to put your diocese under the oversight of another head. Some say within the hour you made that request. Why? What is your overriding concern?
Well, I think our overriding concern is that we do not believe with any conviction that she is authentically a bishop of the Catholic Church.
And by Catholic, we should say small c.
Yes, by that I mean the universal church.
Right.
The church dating its practice and faith and order back to the first century and the New Testament church.
Right.
And that's complicated by the fact that not only we don't accept the ordination of women as priests and bishops, but she really is not in the mainstream of Christian orthodoxy theologically.
She would say that what she is hearing from her flock and in her faith is that this is the right thing to do. Why do you say that it's not?
Well, I don't think that you ever act unilaterally, which is what some of the dioceses, including her diocese, has done in terms of authorizing the blessing of same-sex unions, nor should a change of this nature be made on the basis of just one national church, the Episcopal Church, deciding, contrary to 2,000 years of church teaching, that this is suddenly right. I think the burden of proof is upon the innovators, not those who uphold the historic teaching of Scripture.
Bishop Eicher, what is your flock telling you?
Obviously, we have people on both sides of all the kinds of issues in every diocese and every congregation in the life of the church today. But overwhelmingly, what I'm hearing from my flock is a sense of despair and dismay about the Episcopal Church flaunting its own independence and, in a sense, theological arrogance at the rest of the church. And that's what's brought us to an unprecedented time of division and brokenness in the life of the church, both in the States and internationally.
And I'm sure you're aware that within your flock there are those who are very much against your thinking. We're reading Katie Sherrod's blog, and her complaint, and she's a member of the diocese, and her complaint is that she feels that you say that Episcopalians in Fort Worth either support the network of churches there or embrace the gay agenda. And she says, wait a minute, I don't support what the network is saying, in other words, that you don't support the election of Bishop Katharine, for instance, But she doesn't know what the gay agenda is, and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't necessarily want to move into that column either. So,
she's saying that. I don't think she's being honest. I mean, she's one of the most outspoken, ardent advocates of the gay agenda, which means a normalization of a gay lifestyle, an alternative lifestyle for Christian believers. I mean, there are people of varying degrees in the life of the church in every diocese on these issues that divide us. But the question is, who's the authority in the life of the church, and by whose teaching are we going to abide? We say that it's the authority of Jesus Christ as revealed to us in Holy Scriptures as the Word of God, and that's what's been handed down to us as the faith received by the church from the time of the apostles. This seems but to be a very small group of a left-wing perspective trying to engineer change through use of the church.
We're not going to debate here what the Bible says about women or homosexuality or you know, and the roles in the church. But, you know, those who support your thinking have said that they feel that the Episcopal Church in America is sort of choosing what they want to choose to follow in the Bible and adjusting where they want to adjust. When it comes, though, to schism, the idea that you and others who disagree with the election of Bishop Catherine and the ordination of Gene Robinson, how far are you willing to go? Will you break off from the church?
As you well know, the Windsor report issued by the Archbishop of Canterbury's Communion Commission invited the Episcopal Church to reconcile with the rest of the communion because of what the Episcopal Church had done to break that relationship. So if there's anyone breaking from the church, the wider body, it's the advocates of that 2003 action of General Convention about Vicki Jean Robinson and the blessing of same-sex unions. Mm.
You may see them as, you know, leaving you. You know, we haven't left the church left us. Mm-hmm. You may see it that way, but in effect, you would have to make some sort of move to disengage from that church now because they are running it. I mean, you know, Bishop Catherine is running it. So would you take that step, and how would you take that step?
I think we're differentiating ourselves from them and saying, well, we're faithful Episcopalians, but not that kind of Episcopalian, not the kind that tries to rewrite Scripture through majority votes at national conventions. Mm. And our appeal for alternative primatial oversight is simply saying that Catherine is not the appropriate person to represent those of a conservative, traditional, biblical viewpoint.
Your diocese doesn't ordain women, does it?
No.
What do you say, though, to a woman who says that God has chosen me to preach, to be the priest?
Well, obviously, I have those conversations from time to time with women aspirants who feel called to the priesthood. And after a time of consultation with them, if I feel that there is something authentic about what I'm hearing and what they're saying to me, I have an arrangement with my neighboring Diocese of Dallas where I refer them to Bishop Stanton, who does ordain women to the priesthood. And I suppose there's about five women, perhaps, from Fort Worth that I've led through that process and have been ordained in the Diocese of Dallas and are serving as priests there.
Huh.
The fact is, Robin, we could be wrong in opposing the ordination of women to the priesthood, but I'm not convinced that we are. And it could be that in time, the side that has been innovating on this will be proven wrong. And hopefully they'll have the humility to admit that if that time comes. But the verdict is still out on this, and it's by no means the consensus of the Anglican Church worldwide that women can be priests.
Right, Reverend Jack Leo Eicher, Bishop of Fort Worth, Texas. I wonder, I think we should make an appointment to speak in 5 years, 10
okay.
years, and see, you know, just see what the interpretations are then. You know,
yeah.
Just curious. Bishop Eicher, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Again, the Right Reverend Jack Leo Eicher, Bishop of Fort Worth, Texas. To hear our interview with Bishop Catherine Jeffords Shorey, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Astronomers around the world are celebrating today after NASA Administrator Michael Griffin announced plans to send a shuttle mission to repair the hobbled Hubble Space Telescope. Today's announcement reverses a decision by the previous NASA Administrator, who had said a rehab mission would be too dangerous. The Hubble has captured some of the most spectacular images of deep space and has allowed scientists to observe the universe as it was 12 billion years ago. But scientists say it would become space junk in 2 to 3 years without repairs. Dr. Michael Shara worked at the Space Telescope Science Institute for 17 years. That's the organization that runs the Hubble science missions. He's now astrophysics curator at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He joins us now. And Dr. Shara, your reaction when you heard that the Hubble is going to have a chance?
Oh, I'm just delighted to hear it. And I think much of the astronomical community feels the same way. The telescope is so incredibly powerful, touches on essentially all areas of astronomy and astrophysics, and at the same time connects so well with non-astronomers, just shows them the splendor of the cosmos, that I think we're all thrilled.
What needs to be fixed?
A lot. The batteries are running down. The gyroscopes are having problems. One of the fine guidance sensors, the devices that lock onto the stars that keep the Hubble from jittering, has to be replaced. And at the same time, there's a broken instrument on board that the astronauts are going to try and fix, in addition to putting two brand new instruments, a spectrograph and a camera, on board. So it's a major overhaul of the telescope.
Well, and we understand it's sort of the brain surgery of telescope repair. Extremely delicate, extremely risky, and potentially dangerous. You know, there are people who are going to go up to do this. So you know the criticism that, you know, really, is it worth the risk, first of all, to the Hubble? One false move and apparently you could kick over a telescope or something. And is it worth the risk to humans?
Well, in terms of the risk to the telescope, if we do nothing, we're going to lose it by about 2009. Mm-hmm. It is degrading. We've already lost some functionality on board, and it's definitely getting older. Pieces are wearing out, and we're going to have a catastrophic failure sooner or later. So I think that everybody in the astronomical community who works with Hubble agrees that this is the only way to go. The risk to humans is non-trivial. We all know how dangerous the shuttle can be. Just taking a spacewalk anytime you're out there is a dangerous thing.
I was just thinking on the recent flight of the two astronauts trying to deliver, you know, I think it was a lug wrench or something they were trying to exchange, and we got to listen in on that. And it was, you know, it was touch and go.
Yes. At the same time, these are incredible professionals. These are people who have trained for years, know exactly what they're doing, understand the risks completely, and are really dedicated to advancing science, to advancing our knowledge of what the universe is all about. They know the risks full well. They accept them. And I think we in the astronomical community really just root for them, cheer them on, and we accept those risks with them.
Well, we know that the Hubble has shown, you know, the centers of most galaxies populated by supermassive black holes. We've seen pictures of baby stars, stars just forming. But some people say that this mission, which will take place in 2008 to repair the Hubble, you know, really, what are the practical applications? I mean, what is it that, you know, we have to have from the Hubble?
We certainly want to get back the full functionality of what we call spectroscopy. It's the ability to break light up into its constituent colors and do the real physics in astrophysics. It's a kind of DNA typing of stars and galaxies where we can really get at the guts of what's going on, in addition to being able to test out and use a very powerful new set of infrared and ultraviolet cameras and spectrographs. The practical application of all of this, in a sense, it's like the practical application of having Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or not having it. It teaches us something about what the universe is all about. It's beautiful, it's inspiring, it's something that people deeply care about and connects with what we are as a human race. So that is the practical application. Now, it's certainly taught us that the universe, the Hubble has taught us that the universe is accelerating. There's dark energy there, something we had never known before. Whether that'll have practical application 50 years from now, we can't tell, but it's only by doing this kind of discovery science that we're going to make progress ultimately in science.
Dr. Michael Shara, curator of astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History, speaking about NASA's announcement today to fix the Hubble Space Telescope, something he's very happy about. Dr. Shara, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Young, It's Here and Now. On this Halloween, a story of a woman tried as a witch. Not in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. The trial of Helen Duncan, also known as Hellish Nell, took place in a British court in March of 1944. She wasn't a witch. She was a medium, a psychic, who claimed to channel spirits. And dozens of respected Brits testified it worked. They saw their loved ones, ghost-like images that literally came out of Helen's mouth. But British authorities began to notice that some of Helen's dead spirits knew too much about top-secret British troop movement. The Allied invasion was imminent. Loose lips, even if they belonged to the dead, could sink ships.
Suddenly, the chief constable had a very simple way out of the Helen Duncan quagmire. Nab the woman for faking spooks, and quietly throw away the key. No one need ever know about her unfortunate ability to accurately forecast military secrets. With a self-satisfied smirk, West issued an order. Fred, catch the gifted Mrs. Duncan red-handed. Get me that sheet.
The sheet was what authorities assumed Helen was using to fake ghostly apparitions. Did they ever find one? Nina Chandler explores this truly unbelievable but true World War II tale in her new book, The Strange Case of Hellish Nell, The Story of Helen Duncan and the Witch Trial of World War II. And she joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
I'm very glad to be here, Robin.
What a read, especially on a windy day.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's very Halloween-like.
It sort of is, and it's hard to believe, you know, a trial for witchcraft in the 1940s. But set the scene for us at the time. First of all, seances, this is the middle of the London Blitz. Seances were hugely popular in Britain.
Enormously popular. War was very good for the poltergeist business. There were an estimated 50,000 seance circles all over the British Isles.
They were societies. They were well respected.
Some of them attracted some of the most prestigious people in Britain. I mean, from members of the War Cabinet to brigadiers, one who was in charge of military intelligence for Scotland.
To Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yes.
Creator of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes. He was like the grandfather and the patriarch, the beloved patriarch of the spiritualists.
And the spiritualists were, in effect, it was a religion to them, and they were what, trying to prove?
I think what they were trying to prove beyond any doubt was the existence of eternal life. And they felt they could do that by being in contact with ghosts.
And into the scene walks Helen Duncan, Hellish Nell, as she became known, a well-known medium in the early 1940s. But she began, you know, it's a very sad story about a little girl in Scotland who felt that she was talking to the dead, and her mother warned her off this.
She was very ostracized. And her mother predicted, actually, her mother made a number of predictions, probably to warn her off more than anything else, but they were that she would be tried as a witch and that she would be thrown in prison. And she lived with this fear. At the same time, she felt it was a sacred calling to be a medium.
Well, and the fear became realized, but let's explain what happened on the way. She became a celebrated medium. There were salons set up where these seances would take place. She would be set up on sort of a stage. Ultimately, she would channel a fellow named Albert. Now, who was Albert?
Albert was her primary what they called control, what we might call a spirit guide. And he was an entirely different kind of character than Helen in terms of her personality. She was very shy to the point of being practically catatonic at times. And Albert, who would appear as kind of this white apparition from behind a curtain, was sort of like the Bob Barker of the seance set. I mean, he was just like this master of ceremonies who would pop out and start calling people from the audience and having people from the other side come through and talk to them. And it was like sort of a borderline between worship and vaudeville.
And The Price is Right.
And The Price is Right. Exactly.
I mean, it's really amazing when you read about these scenes. Let's talk about the things that were said in these seances that caught the ear of top British intelligence officials. What were some of the things that Albert, the spirit guide, predicted as opposed to what everyone else in Britain thought at the time?
Everyone was predicting that Germany would invade by land and that it would be a quick and bloody victory. And he said, no, that Germany would not invade. He said that Britain and Russia would become allies.
Well, then, further, during the seances, during one, a young sailor appeared wearing the cap of the SS Barham and said his ship had sunk. It had sunk, but no Brits knew about that. In fact, the British authorities had gone so far to cover that up, they sent out Christmas cards from the sailors to the families. So no one knew that. And here she is saying it during this seance, which leads to this trial. Did they think she was a spy?
They didn't know if she was a spy or not. What they did feel is that she got it right, and they didn't care why she got it right. They simply wanted her put away behind bars until they were sure that it was safe to have someone who, for some, in their view, ungodly reason, got this very strategic information right sometimes.
Okay. She lost in the trial. She did go to jail for 6 months. She was released, coincidentally, right when the war turned and the Allies were winning. But what I want to know is, what is this? What is this story about? You are a licensed psychologist.
Yes.
Do you think she was Sybil-like, that she had a multiple personality disorder?
Yeah, I do, actually. That's what I actually think. I actually think that she was a very, very troubled woman, and that her tendency to escape from the pain of her life into other personalities, to disassociate, was encouraged by spiritualism.
That explains maybe the different voices that she could speak in, but how do you explain the ectoplasm, which everyone in Britain seemed to be an expert on, this white sort of image that would float out and look like the dead?
My tendency is to straddle the line between credibility and complete skepticism. When I was in Britain and I would meet people who had such sincere belief, I found it impossible to question their faith. At the same time, I think that any woman who's supporting 6 children and a feeble husband,
which she was,
would be under pressure to produce phenomenon on a very regular basis in order to put food on the table.
Yes, it just still doesn't explain why. There was even a police raid where there were police planted in the seance.
Absolutely.
And at the time when the ghostly apparition came out, one policeman dove on it and was pawing on the ground to try to get it.
Absolutely.
And many people saw this. And she went through the most embarrassing, humiliating physical exams prior to every seance. They looked in every orifice to make sure she didn't have some sort of muslin or something that she was, you know, maybe, you know, spitting out or something. The answer to the question we posed at the beginning, they never found a sheet.
They never, ever found the sheet. They went through incredible preparation to try to nab this sheet. There were policemen stationed at the back of the room and in the room and downstairs under the window. And everybody, you know, they rushed the seance room and they searched everybody and they never found the sheet, which just makes the mystery of it more fun and leaves it much more to the reader to kind of try to figure out what's credible and what's not.
It's just a fun book. Nina Chandler, the book is The Strange Case of Hellish Nell, the story of Helen Duncan and the witch trial of World War II. Nina, thanks so much.
Oh, I'm very glad to have been here, and thank you so much for having me in.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Happy Halloween. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.